Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we take a look at France's oldest and most controversial nuclear reactor as authorities prepare to decide its future.
Le risque zéro n'existe pas, on l'a vu.
There is no such thing as zero risk, but if anything were to happen, we know what to do.
Also on today's show, in vitro meat, fracking in Germany, and we speak to a filmmaker who's gone on the trail of food waste.
Most produce only have dates which have nothing to do with health concerns. For instance, a yogurt, if it's beyond the date, even weeks sometimes beyond the date, it's still perfect to eat.
Those stories are coming up later in the show. I'm Nathan Witkop. Welcome to Living Planet. The Rhine River separates France and Germany, dividing both countries in more ways than one. On the French side, in Alsace, stands Fessenheim, the oldest and most controversial atomic power station in France. On the other side of the Rhine, only 1.5 kilometres away, slightly less than a mile, is the German state of Baden-Württemberg, where the anti-nuclear movement has been deeply entrenched for decades. Next month, in November, the French government will decide whether or not to prolong the life of Fessenheim's reactors for another 10 years. But times are changing. French anti-nuclear activism is no longer a fringe movement in a country that's long championed nuclear energy. Diana Fong picks up the story from Fessenheim.
I am standing on the French side of the Chalampé-Neuenburg bridge that connects France to Germany. This region of Alsace has changed hands a number of times since 1648. Now hundreds of Germans are again approaching from the other side of the Rhine, but this time they are coming as allies. They're here to join a growing number of French anti-nuclear activists at a rally to stop Fessenheim. Anti-nuclear demonstrations have taken place here ever since the Fessenheim Atomic Power Station was built in the 1970s. But since Japan's Fukushima nuclear disaster in March, the protests have stepped up. There are men and women, young and old, Germans, French, and even the Swiss from the city of Basel, some 40 kilometres south of here. I ask people why they're against nuclear power.
Because it's dangerous. We could have an earthquake here. We saw that with Fukushima. We were against the construction of Fessenheim over 30 years ago, when other nuclear power stations had also been planned in the region. Only Fessenheim was built. It's still dangerous.
The issue is not just about nuclear power, but about Fessenheim in particular. This tiny village of over 2,000 people lies on a Rhine Valley rift that destroyed nearby Basel in an earthquake back in the Middle Ages. At the time Fessenheim was being built in the 1970s, plans for another atomic station in Wiel on the German side of the Rhine were scrapped due to massive opposition. In Germany, the anti-nuclear movement had already taken root, long before the accidents at Three Mile Island in the US or Chernobyl in the former Soviet Union.
The problem with Fessenheim is, if there ever is an accident, it will be no accident but a catastrophe.
Unlike Japan, where the radioactive fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi plant blew into the Pacific Ocean, Fessenheim is situated in the heart of Western Europe. The nuclear site's twin reactors, which were commissioned in the late 1970s, are the oldest in France. And critics say age is only one of Fessenheim's problems. Claude Maillet is on the board of the anti-nuclear lobby Stop Fessenheim.
On le sait, donc l'Alsace est sur une zone sismique.
For one, Alsace is already in an area of seismic activity. On top of that, the nuclear plant was built below the water level of the Grand Canal of Alsace. So if an earthquake were to break the dam, the reactors and safety pumps could be damaged by floods.
Rupture, disons, des pompes et refroidissement, donc voilà. Hein?
Echoes of Fukushima, in other words.
If we have a Basel earthquake direct under Fessenheim, Fessenheim will break. But that's only one thing. Fessenheim is not safe, but we say all atomic power stations all over the world are not safe.
That's Axel Meyer, head of the Freiburg section of the environmental group BUND, the German chapter of Friends of the Earth. Meyer argues that even the most vigilant safeguards cannot protect against human error, sabotage, or the unpredictable forces of nature.
We had the Chernobyl accident, and all the experts said Chernobyl accident is never possible in Germany and in France. We had Fukushima, and now the experts say Fukushima accident is not possible in Germany and in France. But that's not the problem. The problem is we don't know what kind of accident we have for the next accident. Maybe we have a terrorist act against atomic power station. Maybe we have an earthquake. There are so many different things which can happen. And if we have this accident, it's a kind of accident we can't believe.
The atomic power station is the main industry of Fessenheim. It employs 700 people in the area and provides the city council half of its revenues. I spoke to Madame Le Maire, Fessenheim Mayor Fabienne Stich, who is prepared in the unlikely event of a nuclear accident.
Le risque zéro n'existe pas, on l'a vu.
There is no such thing as zero risk, but if anything were to happen, we know what to do. We conduct emergency practice drills in schools, and every family in the village is equipped with a supply of iodine tablets should the worst happen.
Iodine pills counteract dangerous levels of radiation, but hopefully they won't be necessary. The Fessenheim reactors regularly undergo vigorous safety checks, as well as EU-wide stress tests against earthquakes and other natural disasters.
Estimates for an earthquake here are based on the one in Basel, which was assessed at 6.2 on the Richter scale. Fessenheim was built with a safety margin to resist a magnitude of 6.7.
No country in the world is as dependent on atomic energy as France, where 58 reactors produce some 80% of the country's entire electricity needs, providing even enough for export. Ironically, to neighbours such as Germany, which is phasing out its nuclear programme over the next 10 years.
Nein zu Fessenheim!
On the other side of the Rhine, the Germans shut down their nuclear power plants, but they buy electricity from us. Then they come over here to tell us to shut down Fessenheim. I find that's a bit hypocritical.
Mayor Stich expects the reactors to pass EU inspection in November, but worries that Fessenheim is such a political hot potato that it could become a sacrificial lamb nonetheless. After Fukushima, polls show that the majority of French are now opposed to nuclear power.
The reactors are technically sound, so I can only hope that Fessenheim won't be sacrificed in the run-up to the presidential elections.
Au moment des élections présidentielles.
The French elections will be next spring, so the pressure to shut down Fessenheim, a political liability, is mounting. Diana Fong, Deutsche Welle Radio, in Fessenheim, France.
From one energy dispute to another now, hydraulic fracturing, commonly known as fracking, is a technique used to get natural gas from difficult locations like coal beds or shale. Like the full name suggests, it involves using water pressure to crack underground rocks. The technique has been around for decades, but high energy prices are making unconventional deposits of gas a lot more interesting for mining companies. In the United States, fracking is going through a boom, but it's not without its critics. They're concerned about health and environmental impacts. In Europe, countries are split on the issue, and here in Germany, resistance to fracking is mounting. Nina Haser reports.
Office clerk Martin Knepper normally wouldn't bother to care about gas, but that changed a couple of months ago. He heard that fracking was coming to his hometown of Hamm, a small city in western Germany.
I
did some research online and saw that this has been deployed in the US for years with disastrous environmental effects. thousands of liters of chemicals are pumped into the ground to break up rock formations. But methane enters the groundwater. In some places, a whole region's groundwater has been contaminated. It's a very risky enterprise.
The father of two has joined a citizens group to resist this technique of drilling for gas in unconventional locations. These may be places with gas deposits that once upon a time were dismissed as too inconvenient because the pores in the rocks below ground were not connected. Ritva Westendorf-Lahuz, a spokesperson for ExxonMobil, says hydraulic fracturing allows the oil and gas industry to get to those hard-to-reach places.
The fracking technique tries to break the rock or to form small cracks of approximately 1 centimeter. You do this with water pressure. The trouble is, once you take that water pressure away, the rock simply closes up again. So you have to do something to keep them open. That's where you pump sand underground.
The sand keeps the cracks open to allow the gas through. But there's a problem, as sand and water don't mix well. So the drilling companies turn to chemicals, and that's what horrifies Martin Knepper.
There are long lists of chemicals that are deployed. For someone who's not a chemist, it's hard to get your head around what's being used.
Part of the reason is that the water-sand solution needs to shift between two different states. In order to pump the mixture 1,000 to 5,000 meters below ground, substances are added to make the fluid more viscous. That's to stop the sand from settling. But when this mixture reaches its destination, the process needs to be reversed. The sand is supposed to stay underground, but the water needs to be pumped back so that it doesn't get in the way of the natural gas. This requires a different set of chemicals. On top of this, biocides are used to keep bacteria and yeast at bay.
The amount of chemical additives overall is usually very small, sometimes less than 0.2% of the fluid. Sometimes it's 2 to 5%. It depends on the site. But the overall fluid is not dangerous to the environment, poisonous or obliged to be declared under the Chemicals Act. No hazardous substance is produced.
But that doesn't mean that the fluid's constituent parts are harmless. The biocides, for example, are considered dangerous to the environment, and other chemicals used in the process are poisonous. It's only the heavy dilution that's claimed to be safe.
Well, look at the dilution this way. You use about 4 million liters of water when fracking and dilute it with 80,000 liters of chemicals. For me, 80,000 liters is a lot, definitely too much to pump it into our soil.
And many others agree with Martin Knepper. Another citizens' initiative in Germany recently handed a petition of 13,000 signatures to the federal government, urging it to ban fracking. The government has issued a moratorium for two new sites of shale and coal seam gas deposits. ExxonMobil can only proceed with fracking there pending a scientific review. But the company hasn't given up on the procedure and is already eyeing another potential site in Germany. Company spokesperson Westendorf-Lahuz again.
The technique has been tested and approved. It's been used in Germany for 50 years to boost production at conventional sites or to make gas production possible in tight gas deposits. This technique has been used in Germany about 300 times without any incident where this technique polluted drinking water.
Last year, a documentary about the alleged impact of fracking in the US caused a stir. The documentary showed water so heavily polluted with methane that it was possible to ignite it with a lighter as it came out of tap in a person's home. This is the kind of scenario that Knepper is worried about occurring in Germany. But ExxonMobil says the water table is secure.
The drilling itself is not just a hole in the ground. It's like a telescopic construction. At the depth of the water table, the borehole is insulated with several layers of steel and cement to make sure no chemicals or gas penetrate groundwater.
Martin Knepper isn't convinced. He says it's not worth the risk in one of Europe's most densely populated regions. Nina Hase, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Time now on the show for a quick look at some news from the past week. Here's Sulfika Abani.
Eco News.
Salvage crews have managed to board a cargo ship that ran aground off the coast of New Zealand's North Island earlier this month and have checked the vessel's stability. It has leaked about 300 tonnes of heavy fuel oil since hitting a reef in the Bay of Plenty and threatened to break up in rough storms in the past week. Clumps of oil and some of the ship's cargo have washed up on nearby beaches, including one which authorities say contains a hazardous substance. The company in charge of the ship, Costamare Shipping, has apologised, and the ship's captain and second officer have been charged and appeared in court. In a new report, Britain's Royal Society of Scientists is calling for a World Nuclear Forum to agree on a uniform international approach to nuclear safety. Released 2 days after the British Environment Ministry approved the expansion of the local nuclear industry, the report says this year's Fukushima accident had, quote, shown we cannot be complacent about nuclear safety. German environmental groups have criticised plans to reform European farming subsidies under the bloc's common agricultural policy, known as the CAP. Supporters of the reforms say they're necessary to meet a growing food shortage. But some environmental groups, including Friends of the Earth Germany, say the proposed rules for protecting green spaces and limiting monocultures don't go far enough. They do welcome plans to tie direct subsidy payments to certain ecological and social criteria. A Nepal-based group called Eco Himal has asked the Nepalese government to consider installing portable toilets on Mount Everest. Eco Himal says the thousands of trekkers who set off from the South Base Camp in Nepal to reach the summit of the world's highest mountain need to be given the means to keep the place clean. Human waste is a problem, says the group's director, Pinjo Sherpa. Sherpa says some expeditions bring their own portable toilets, but others are forced to use the nearest snowdrift. Another group, the Eco Everest Expedition of Nepal, says it has collected 13 tonnes of rubbish from Everest since 2008.
Sulfika Abani there with the Eco News. And if you're looking for more of our environment content, come check out our webpage. That's dwworld.de/environment. Each year, your average German throws away 310 euros worth of food that hasn't even been taken out of its packaging. That's according to a documentary that's just hitting the cinemas here called Taste the Waste. The film follows the trail of our wasteful production chains from farms to kitchens, and it arrives at some big numbers. 90 million tons of food is thrown out in Europe each year. Globally, enough food is squandered to fill a chain of trucks around the planet. Valentin Thurn is the filmmaker behind the project, and I spoke to him before the show.
The World Food Organization speaks about a third of all food is being thrown away. So even when you calculate the rich countries throw away more than the poorer countries, at the end you come to a third of all. For Europe, for the European Union, it sums up to 90 million tons of food every year.
And is that food that's being thrown away in people's households, or are we looking at food that's being thrown away from supermarkets because it's gone off?
No, it's all the chain. It starts from agriculture. Probably it's a third of it, it's from the agriculture, a third of it, it's transport and trade, and a third in the consumers' households. There is not one single bad guy who is responsible. It's a system who evolved in the last decades, and we as consumers are in the middle of this system.
You say there's no one single bad guy. Is there anyone that you tend to blame more than others? Who would you like to see take the first steps?
As a consumer, everybody who feels concerned can take the first step for himself. Nobody has to wait for anybody else. If we always wait for the politicians, nothing will be done. But they have their responsibility too. I mean, I've seen in Britain, for instance, politicians have been founding an institute, the Waste Resources Action Program, and they did a lot of campaigning in the whole country, and this really motivated a lot of people to reduce their food waste. So politics has power, and they also influenced a lot of supermarket chains to do their own campaigns.
What specific steps could supermarkets take to behave differently, to cut down on waste?
I mean, the biggest cut downs they could do would be abolishing the standards and norms they have. They don't do that because they fear that in this competition they have with other supermarkets, the people will turn away from them and go to the other ones who still have all the shelves always full at any time of the day and everything in an optical perfect state. I mean, they really oblige the farmer to sort out apples, tomatoes, potatoes, whatever, which are not perfectly in its optics. So, I mean, this is really a huge amount which has nothing to do with nutritional value.
Surely no business has an interest in waste.
That's true. I mean, they try to reduce wasting values because of economic reasons, but they also try to get as much consumers as possible, and they think they only can keep them when having the shelves always full. And that means when new produce is arriving, they have to throw out the old one. And especially when you think about the varieties, I mean, they really have the impression that a consumer which is not getting its favorite yogurt or bread is turning around and going to the competitor.
And where do things like use-by dates or expiry dates, best-before dates, these labels, where do they fit into this problem as far as you're concerned? Well,
the biggest problem is that they're totally confusing. Consumers don't know the difference between these different dates. In the end, they throw out everything which is beyond the date, no matter which date, but there are big differences. There's, for instance, the sell-by date, which has a real connection to health. And you should not go beyond that.
So you're not advocating getting rid of dates that are useful for health purposes?
No, definitely. This is helping us a lot. But the thing is that we cannot really distinguish between this health concern date and the other ones. Most produce only have dates which have nothing to do with health concerns. For instance, a yogurt, if it's beyond the date, even weeks sometimes beyond the date, it's still perfect to eat. You just have to open it to smell, to trust your senses, or to taste. And if it's gone, you will taste it, and then you throw it away. There's no problem for your health having tasted it.
So humans should learn to have a bit more faith in their own nose and tongue, perhaps.
Truly, but especially people in the cities, we don't learn about quality, how we can distinguish quality and lower quality. And we have to take a little bit more time to find out what is good, what is bad.
Another novel idea that I heard you identify is that one introduced by a Dutch supermarket, which tried to reverse the way in which consumers typically behave in their stores. What did they do?
Yeah, that's really a cute idea. They said to their customers, you can have everything you find in our shelves, which is 2 days before the expiry date or less. You can have it for free. And now this is really changing the optics. People usually tend to look for the longest expiry dates. Now they're looking for the shortest.
Finally, on, I guess, a lighter note, what was the last piece of food that you threw away that you felt bad about?
Oh, yeah, that's only 3 days ago. I mean, it happens. I mean, you can't go really to zero waste. When I went for traveling for the cinema tour, I forgot a pot of lentil soup in the fridge, and when I came back, it was gone. It's a pity, but it's like that.
And I have to confess to throwing away some rice myself this week. That was Valentin Tuin, director of Taste the Waste, a documentary on the food we throw away. From wasting food now to choosing food, would you eat meat that was grown in a lab? Perhaps one day you'll have that choice. In fact, the European Science Foundation held a conference on lab-grown meat in Sweden just last month. Even if it may be some time before this is something that could be a reality in the supermarket, Dutch universities are leading the research. Cynthia Taylor reports from the Netherlands.
In vitro meat aims to reduce the number of animals needed to feed the world's population and to lower the CO2 impact animal breeding has in the environment.
Keeping animals, housing animals, feeding animals, killing the animals and then taking the meat, that all costs energy and food, and that's a huge impact on the environment.
That's Bernard Roelen, a professor of veterinary science at Utrecht University. He's extracted hundreds of adult stem cells from pigs' muscle tissue.
If we can do the same without having animals, without culturing animals, but do it in a culture dish, it would mean that we would have to have fewer animals to produce something to eat for us.
Scientists working on this believe that 10 adult stem cells could help produce some 50,000 tons of meat. And that's because they keep multiplying every 24 hours, easily reaching an 18-figure number within a couple of months. The method isn't new. Scientists have been focusing on this within the field of regenerative medicine for years, but only recently has it been seen as an alternative to traditional meat. After Roland's work is done, the adult stem cells will be sent to the biomedical engineering department of Eindhoven University.
So what we have here is a plastic plate. Inside those plastic plates you can see pieces of Velcro. And in between those pieces of Velcro, a small tissue is being formed.
Daisy van der Schaft is a professor of biomechanics at Eindhoven University. She and her team work on inducing the stem cells to mature and grow into three-dimensional muscle tissue. In other words, to produce meat.
The red thing that you see, the fluid, so this tissue is formed inside a fluid, and this fluid is the medium. And this medium that contains all the growth factors and the sugars, amino acids, things that the cells need to survive, need to live, need to grow.
Van der Schaft used about 1 million adult stem cells to produce this tissue. It's about 8 millimeters long and 0.5 millimeter thick. It won't grow more than this. It lacks fat and blood vessels like traditional meat. That's something to focus on later, says Van der Schaft. These little tissues look like minced meat, and the idea is to make a hamburger or sausage out of them. A lab-made steak or pork chop is still way off.
You will need to make a reactor, a bioreactor, a culturing machine, basically, in which you can perfuse through a tissue so that you have enough oxygen, enough nutrients to supply all the cells inside that thicker tissue. Otherwise, if you have a large tissue and you don't supply this perfusion, then it will die in the middle part.
A bioreactor like this doesn't exist yet. But that's not van der Schaft's main priority. So far, her success has been with mice tissue only. The rodents served as a test run. Now her team is working on translating that same process onto pork. In vitro meat hasn't reached the supermarket shelves yet, and it probably won't for some time. However, it may be helped along by another Dutch academic, Cor van der Velle, a professor of philosophy at Wageningen University. She's been researching consumers' reaction to in vitro meat through personal surveys. Her initial findings show what she calls the yuck response, a sort of distaste for the idea.
In many cases, these yuck responses were rather fleeting, because almost in the next sentence already, people sometimes said, so wait a minute, if I realize what it could mean for animals, then it already looks a bit different.
Despite all this hope, researchers still need to extract stem cells regularly from animals, as the adult stem cells stop multiplying after a couple of months. So they are now trying to isolate embryonic stem cells, which they believe will continue multiplying indefinitely. But it could take a decade until results are in place, though. Cynthia Taylor, Deutsche Welle Radio, Amsterdam. Do you belong to what you're hanging on
to? Are you caught in a loop? Thanks for tuning in. I hope you liked the show, and hopefully we'll catch you again next week. Excuse me, please.